Good afternoon and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, Chris Massini introduces us to poet, Yale University professor, and this year's Race and Racism lecture presenter at Gonzaga University, Claudia Rankin. We've also got Vern Wyndham's chat with Stage Left Theater's Susan Hardy, director of their current production, An Iliad. I've got the latest from the Coeur d'Alene Music Conservatory with Executive Director Julene Dance, and Nathan Weinbender has a review of a new documentary film, Some Kind of Heaven. Music, in honor of Black History Month, is from composers Florence Price, R. Nathaniel Dett, and William Grant Still, played by pianist Jenny Slotcheber, a recent virtual guest on our Piano Bench program. This is Northwest Arts Review.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. My guest today is Claudia Rankin, a poet, essayist, and professor at Yale University. Her 2014 book, Citizen, An American Lyric, which explores the relentless personal effects of microaggressions and everyday racism, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. In her latest book, Just Us, An American Conversation, Rankin sets out to have uncomfortable conversations with white people about race and how or whether they perceive their own whiteness. Using funds from her 2016 MacArthur Fellowship, Rankin founded the Racial Imaginary Institute, an interdisciplinary center for writers, artists, and scholars to examine whiteness and race as social constructs. She is this year's guest for Gonzaga University's fourth annual Race and Racism Lecture, which will be live streamed at 6 p.m. Wednesday, February 10th. Claudia Rankin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, thank you for having me, Chris.
So one thing that I really appreciate about your work is how it helps bring into focus the ways in which these big structural systemic racism translates into personal experiences and sort of one-on-one interactions between people. And I wonder if you can just sort of set us up by talking about that decision to use that really close focus in your work.
Well, I think a lot of people talk about systemic racism and institutional racism and, use this language that suggests that the racism is happening over there and not where you stand in a day-to-day way. And institutions are made up of people. If it's systemic because people are allowing things to continue from generation to generation. So I wanted to show that the very people who make up the courts, who make up institutions like Yale, where I teach, and who work in the drugstore and encounter in the hospital are the people who are holding these beliefs, and then the beliefs play themselves out in both policy decisions and interactions. So that was the sort of organizational structure I was trying to replicate by having these conversations.
I'm talking with Claudia Rankin. She's a poet and essayist and professor, and she'll be giving the annual Race and Racism Lecture at Gonzaga University on February 10th. In advance of the event, the university paired with high schools in Spokane to get copies of Citizen, about 450 copies, into the hands of high school students. And I'm sure this is not the first time that your book has been used in classrooms and taught. So what do you think engaging with a piece of literature like Citizen or like your new book, Just Us, can add to a classroom discussion of race and racism?
Well, my hope is that it will broaden the discussion. It will allow for other avenues in. it might not be the book for everyone, but for some people, it will be a way to see something they know but have not seen. You know, I've heard people say that Citizen has allowed people to see dynamics that they're involved in day to day, but never actually understood the ramifications of them. I mean, you know, I am somebody who is dedicated to pedagogy my entire life, you know, for the first half of it as a student and the second half of it as a professor. So I clearly believe in the power of literature, the power of books to expand, open, create lines of inquiry, allow me as a reader and as a professor to see and discuss and take apart certain dynamics. So it's all of that that I'm hoping will happen in the classrooms that engage Citizen.
And I've heard you say in other interviews that it's not your job, or it's not the artist's job to, you know, suggest solutions or make prescriptions on what people should do, only to sort of represent what is there out in the world or reflect that. But mm-hmm. I want to push you a little bit on that because, you know, in the poem that opens your new book, Just Us, you really kind of make it personal. You say, I'm here without the shrug, attempting to understand how what I want and what I want from you run parallel. Justice and the openings for Just Us. So clearly there is something that you want both from the individual and from the greater society. So I wonder, is just an awareness of that sort of two realities enough, or do we really need to move toward some concrete actions now?
Well, you know, I want what I want, yes. I mean, I don't think I would ever say I don't want something. I don't believe I can make you change your ways or want what I want. Mm. I don't, you know, I would like that. I would like a way for us to be able to say it's snowing outside today and both of us agree because there's snow on the ground, you know? Whether you decide that you think it shouldn't be shoveled, you know, I can't do anything about that. But... Yeah. But I would like us both to agree that, yes, there is snow on the ground and it's very white and it's covering everything.
Pivoting a little bit to this event with Gonzaga and particularly to Spokane, which is the community where Gonzaga is located, it's a city that is about 85% white. And many rural areas around the city are even more homogeneous. So I think often there's a sense that, you know, well-meaning people here can say or think that, yes, racism is a problem in a big structural sense in the country, but it's not really our problem here. So I wonder if you have thoughts on why these types of uncomfortable conversations about race are important for white people to engage in, even when they may not come into contact with many people of color in their daily lives.
Well, partly because it's not just about coming into contact with people of color, and it's not just about people of color. It is about what whiteness means as well. And, you know, white people are a race in and of themselves. And if you have white supremacists running around in your government, in your state government, in your local government, making decisions for you that don't align with science or don't align with what you know of racial politics in this country, then it's, you know, it's an issue for you as well as for me. You know, one of the terms I dislike is this idea of allyship, because it shouldn't be that white people are allies of black people. They should understand that having justice and equity in their community, in their world, in their democracy is good for them. They should be out there, even if there were no black people, no Jewish people, no women in this country. If you have one white man as misogynist, as racist, as anti-Semitic, as homophobic, you know, white people should be out there saying, no, this will not end up good for me. This will not be a good thing for the democracy
that I want to live in.
My guest has been Claudia Rankin, poet, author, and professor. She'll be delivering Gonzaga University's annual Race and Racism Lecture, which will be live streamed 6 p.m. Wednesday, February 10th. You can find more information about that event at gonzaga.edu/events. Claudia, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. It's really been an honor.
Oh, thank you.
A musical interlude from composer Robert Nathaniel Dett, his Juba, written in 1913 and played here by Jenny Slotcher. We've followed the progress of an audacious startup, the Music Conservatory of Coeur d'Alene, for well over a year now, from initial dream stage to current three-dimensional reality. One thing that has aided their growth is an ongoing series of open houses coupled with sample music lessons. Executive Director Julien Dance reports on their success to date. You have had some real success with these open houses, haven't you?
Well, real success in that everybody who came through the door registered or came again. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just thrilled with that. It's kind of hard to get people to come through the door because of COVID, and we were competing a little bit with the holidays. But we just keep pressing forward, and these open houses, you know, the special thing about them is our faculty is on board, and you can call this number, 425-417-4367, and you can schedule a time to have a free lesson with one of our faculty members. Or you can just come to the open house and visit with the faculty and explore and, you know, find the environment of learning music, because we have a lot of classes that we're offering that aren't private lessons also.
There will be, as you said, faculty members on hand. And if someone is coming back, are there other either instruments or rooms set up that are new since the last set of open houses you had?
Absolutely. All of our studios are set up to teach. We're still bringing in pianos. We want a couple more pianos upstairs in the music conservatory. We'd like a piano in every room. But we have a new choir director coming on, and it's going to be wonderful to introduce her. She will be teaching a youth choir from ages 12 to 18, Her name is Jessica Fennenbach, and she's a voice major graduate from the University of Hawaii. And so that's going to be really fun to have her. She's just vivacious and alive.
And are there any other new faculty appointments that we may not know about?
We have Monica Palmer. She's a flautist. She has a master's in flute performance. Her master's was from the University of Idaho. She is amazing. It's just like being in heaven to listen to her play. And we have Wendy Palmer. She's actually her mother. She teaches early childhood classes for us. She also teaches private piano lessons, and she's directing our children's choir. Then we also have Channing Gads, and I am somewhat related to her. She's my son's wife, but she's been teaching early childhood for probably at least 20 years. She's absolutely magical and so popular. So those classes are filling up fast.
All right.
If I can describe it, it's like we're filling a spot that wasn't ever filled before in Coeur d'Alene. People are loving the newness of studying music. We've got ear training. We've got theory classes. We've got historical classes. Jan Palant is wonderful in his teaching. He teaches historical classes from around the world. So I really believe that what we have to offer is something different than has ever been offered in Coeur d'Alene. Really, it brings to life the real arts.
February 6th and 10th are the dates of the next open houses at the Coeur d'Alene Conservatory. You can check their Facebook page for more current information. I'm Jim Tevenin. You're listening to Northwest Arts Review, available as a broadcast every Thursday noon on KPBX, and available as well as a podcast from SpokanePublicRadio.org. Some Kind of Heaven is a strange documentary, part comedy, part tragedy, set inside what has been deemed the largest retirement community in Central Florida. Nathan Weinbender takes a visit to the Villages in his review of this unusual and memorable film, now available as a digital rental.
Just about every review of the documentary Some Kind of Heaven is going to invoke the name Errol Morris, and for good reason. Morris, whose Gates of Heaven and The Thin Blue Line are amongst the most revered of nonfiction films, brought a newfound playfulness and visual wit to the documentary form, an arch and heightened style that can be read as either mocking or affectionate, and sometimes both. Lance Oppenheim, who directed Some Kind of Heaven, has a similarly delicate touch. This is a movie that might get criticized for scoffing at its subjects, or for aping Morris's methods a bit too closely, but I think it's filled with affection, as cockeyed as that affection may be, and I think it eventually finds its own strange identity. It's set inside the Florida town known as The Villages, which is essentially the world's largest gated retirement community. It's regularly been named one of America's fastest-growing cities, a manufactured ecosystem that seemed to pop up, fully formed, overnight. It's a world of strip malls, golf courses, nail salons, and chain restaurants. Most of the houses are ticky-tacky boxes stacked side by side, differentiated only by varying shades of beige. The population is almost entirely white and has one of the oldest median ages in the country. It was a Trump stronghold in 2016, though you'd never know an election had even happened from the film, judging by a local news report we see about a resident's new sports car. Oppenheim has stripped away any reference to the political turbulence of the outside world, which is a sly political commentary unto itself, because it underlines just how hermetically sealed this environment is privileged to be. The turbulence instead exists between the walls of these supposedly idyllic homes, and the film focuses on a small group of elderly Villages residents, all at precarious places in their lives. There's Anne and Reggie, whose marriage is being tested because he's experimenting with meditation and psychedelic drugs. Anne is committed to the role of doting wife, listening patiently as Reggie explains how he's actually God reincarnated as a human. We also meet Dennis, who isn't an actual Villages resident, but goes about his days as if he belongs there. He lives in an old van that he parks inside a storage facility at night, and he's on the prowl for a nice, ideally wealthy woman that he can move in with. And then there's Barbara, a soft-spoken retiree who's had to go back to work since her husband's death. Her desire to meet a new man isn't going so well. At a singles event in her neighbor's living room, only 11 people show up, 10 of them women. There are a lot of sad moments in Some Kind of Heaven, particularly as Reggie's recklessness lands him in legal trouble. But there are funny moments too, both intentional and unintentional. A group of women, all named Elaine, introducing themselves one at a time directly into the camera. A consultation about end-of-life services that occurs inside a Ruby Tuesday dining room. A golf cart salesman and Jimmy Buffett superfan who boasts about owning two commercial-grade blenders that are strictly for margaritas. A church service that employs a department store mannequin dressed as Jesus. All of these images have an uncanny quality to them, a quirkiness that falls somewhere between farce and surrealism. The Villages has been referred to as the Disney World for retirees, and that seems fitting because there's always been a sinister undercurrent to the pasted-on smiles and candy-colored uniformity of the so-called happiest place on Earth. Some Kind of Heaven picks up on that offbeat frequency, presenting us with a world that is so manufactured and kitschy that the unsettling and disquieting things happening just below its surface are thrown into even sharper relief. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Nathan Weinbender.
Nathan Weinbender is film and music editor for The Inlander and one of the critics on Spokane Public Radio's Movies 101, heard Friday evenings at 6:30 on KPBX. Spokane's Stage Left Theater is in the midst of the virtual run of Lisa Peterson and Daniel O'Hare's play, An Iliad. Vern Windham and director Susan Hardy talked about the production. Here's part of their conversation.
An Iliad is a one-person show, in this case a one-man show, and it is a retelling of Homer's Iliad, which some of our listeners might be familiar with, but it's the tale of the Trojan War, told by the great ancient Greek poet Homer. And this is a modern-day retelling of the story. Our guide through this is a character we call the poet, played by Robert Tombari here in Spokane. And the poet is a traveler from an ancient world destined to retell the story of the Trojan War throughout time and space to anyone who will listen until such time we no longer have war. So it's a cautionary tale. The wonderful thing about this script is that it brings the issue of war home to us in a very contemporary and meaningful way. So rather than simply being a recanting of the original poem, this is a contemporary outlook on war through the ages and what that means to us now, both in terms of our worldview and brings it home in a very individualistic way as well. It's just a beautiful script.
As you say, he moves through time. Describe a little more exactly how the play uses time, as in recounting precise moments in history or what?
It takes place in the modern day. So our poet actually meets with us in the modern theater of today. In this case, it's Stage Left's stage. He has been telling the story in bars and public squares and theaters and anywhere he can tell it all throughout the ages. In this case, he meets with us at this theater. Or let me say, and we'll get into this too, meets with the cameras who then extrapolate the tale to us because obviously we don't have a live audience at the theater. So we take advantage of that conceit as well. But the story is as old as time, as war is. And it's really a treatise on war, the war that seems never to leave our society. You know, when haven't we been at war, really? And the war within us as well, you know, all those little wars that we deal with through our rage or our personal demons. So, for example, one of my favorite little moments in the play is when the poet looks at us straight in the eye through the camera and says, you know how it feels when somebody cuts you off in traffic and the rage just comes and you just want to kill them? That sort of personal war. And it's kind of a fascinating way to look at rage and hatred and extrapolate it out from our personal selves out to the world.
And as you mentioned, the camera, you know, for those of us who in the old cliched line love the smell of the grease paint and the roar of the crowd, then talk about how you have made this translation for our purposes now.
Well, you know, Vern, we all long for the day when we can actually have living, breathing bodies in a dark theater again to hear our stories. I mean, that's heaven on earth for us. But we can't, so we're doing the next best thing now. And really, I feel like we're embracing the tools we're lucky enough to have right now. We've produced this show in the theater. So when I directed it as a live theater piece. There wasn't a whole lot different that I did this time than I ever do when I'm directing theater. So that was, for me and for the rest of the folks that are involved in this, just such a wonderful exercise to be able to go back into a theater and safely and do our work. But the difference is there were cameras on us, and so we are able to film it and show it through a platform. Some people might be familiar with the stage-to-screen series, whereby a staged production is simply shot with different angles and different cameras. And that's basically what we're doing. It's our own little local stage to screen, and then we present it to you as a live theater performance on tape.
The cameras aim exclusively on the one character, the one person show, on the poet, or they have other views to also bring in?
We had three cameras all aimed at the stage. And through the post-production editing process, we've been able to tighten the view, tighten the shot, go close up, so that we have different views of this character. You know, luckily, we only have one character on stage, and so we had the ability to place the cameras where we needed the camera at any given time. I mean, for the most part, we kept them stable, but there were times when we replaced the camera so we could get the view that we really wanted, keeping in mind that that's what our audience was going to see. So there are moments when our actor is very conscious of the camera and plays to the camera, sticks his face right in there to get his point across, but mostly the actor is playing to what would be an audience in the theater. So it's just been an interesting process, and we've learned a lot along the way, but I'm very excited to see the finished product. My job sort of ended when we got everything in the can, and so the editors took it on after that.
Performances of An Iliad continue tonight through Saturday evening at 7 and Sunday at 2 from StageLeftTheater.org. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Massini and Fern Windham. We're grateful as well for the contributions of Claudia Rankin, Julene Dance, Susan Hardy, and Nathan Weinbender. Jenny Slotcherer takes us out with the music of William Grant Still from her new American Heritage album. Please do join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.